Turn over to the book of the Revelation to find the next church on the list, and that is the assembly in Smyrna. And we go there to chapter 2. Chapter 2 and verse number 8. Revelation 2 and 8. And unto the angel of the church in Smyrna write, these things saith the first and the last, which was dead and is alive. I know thy works and tribulation and poverty, but thou art rich. And I know the blasphemy of them which say they are Jews and are not, but are the synagogue of Satan. Fear none of those things which thou shalt suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison, that you may be tried, and ye shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee a crown of life. Verse 11. He that has an ear, or hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says unto the churches. He that overcometh shall not be hurt of the second death. Now, already you've probably noticed that each writing or each letter addressed to these seven different assemblies or churches finishes off very similarly. He that overcomes. And I think that if we sort of learn that lesson, apart from any other, as a result of the study of these seven churches, I think we will have achieved something. And what lesson is that? That Christ expects us to overcome in this realm just as really and just as essentially as he expects me and expects us to overcome in the outside realm. Now that comes as a rude awakening. We sort of get brought up in the assemblies perhaps, and you're sort of a condition to expect that the ideal exists here, that the ideal occurs, that everything's rosy, everything's lovely. Now, I'm not knocking Acacia Ridge for one moment, but I'm sure that it's no different to anywhere else. And the great lesson, or one of the greatest lessons I feel that we can learn, particularly as younger believers, from the study of the seven churches, is that he expects us to overcome certain things in the realm of the assembly, just as definitely as he expects me to overcome in my daily existence and life in the world outside. Now, he's not talking about trivia, of course. He's not talking about minor details that may occur or practices that may occur in the assembly. But as we look at each church, we'll find that there are conditions over which Christ expects us to overcome. So we can't drift outside. We know that we'll end in disaster if we go out to our daily work or go out to the school place or wherever we find our employment. If we go out there and drift through the day and drift through life, we know we'll end up in spiritual disaster. And just equally true is the fact that we can't come into an assembly and go along with the tide. We have to sum up, we have to assess, we have to consider, we have to chew over, and we have to be fairly critical in our assessment and judgments. Now, in Laodicea, you will have remembered from last week, it was coldness of heart. My, they were doing lots of good things. They had kids' clubs going, they had a Sunday school that was thriving, they had youth, even had youth groups. Many ought to be brave to have one of them. And you name it, they were doing it. But Christ saw it all, and he says, I know your works. I understand, I see, I know all about you. But he says, you know, the greatest problem is your motivation. You're not doing it for the right reason. You're not doing it because of a love and affection for me. I promise you, that's very challenging, isn't it? We do lots of things. I'm right here now. What am I here for? Filling a gap? Trying to keep up with the other brethren that stand here? Am I trying to get a name for myself so that I can sort of get put on a few more programs around Brisbane? Am I here because I get some self-satisfaction from being here? Or am I honestly fulfilling this role because I have an appreciation of the person that I'm serving? And I want to further his interests. Very searching stuff, isn't it? Laodicea was very busy. And they were busy for the wrong reason. We come across then to Smyrna. And the name, meaning of the name, if you have up there the definition, is myrrh. Now myrrh was that perfume. Myrrh was that anesthetic at times as well, that you read of throughout Scripture, both Old and New Testaments. And it had a very sweet fragrance. You read in one of the Psalms that as fragrant as myrrh, cassia and aloes. So obviously the fragrance, the perfume of myrrh was something extremely sweet. But however, as W. Vine's dictionary would tell us, and I encourage us all to have one of those, W. Vine's expository dictionary, as W. Vine would tell us, it's also very bitter in its taste. So you've got sweetness of perfume on the one hand, coming from bitterness on the other. So before we even look at much of the content of Smyrna, of the letter addressed to Smyrna rather, you find that there's already the hint of bitter experience. There's already the hint of suffering. And that can well be written over the title of Smyrna, Suffering, Bitter Experience. On to the next one. The significance of its position. I think this is very relevant and very practical. Remember in Laodicea you had coldness of heart. Now frequently, when that condition exists in God's people, the context or the condition or the experience that will follow hard on the heels of coldness of heart is suffering, persecution, bitter experience. We know ourselves. I was quoting it on Friday night. A late brother, Mr. Alan Oldfield. I remember him now standing at the front of Conference Hall. Where was it? It was in the New Hall, yes. And he said, you know, when the going's good, it's easy to get away. When everything's rosy and everything seems to be running on a schedule and you have no hiccups in proceedings and life seems to be happening and sort of flowing very smoothly, he says, that's when you'll find that frequently it's the case that you get away. I guess we could ask Solomon that question and he'd agree. He had all he could wish for in terms of wisdom, in terms of wealth. He may have had a few too many wives, which didn't help, but in any case, he had everything he seemed to want. I remember his heart was turned away by those idolatrous wives, it seems. But then he said, when the going is a bit more difficult and rougher, and things seem to fall down around our ears at times, then you find yourself making your way back to God all over again. Isn't that the experience? And so I suggest that it's very significant that we've got persecution following immediately on the heels of coldness of heart. Now you see, each church here, or each letter here, is not just addressed to one assembly or group of assemblies at the time. It also represents a period in assembly history. Most would agree that many Bibles will have that as your heading. The first letter to the Ephesians there in Ephesus represents the period of time of the church straight after the apostles, post-apostolic period. And then a period of time we're looking at this morning of Smyrna follows immediately on the heels of that. So you have the time of the apostles, you have coldness of heart coming in immediately after them as represented in Ephesus, and then following that you have the suffering, the persecution of those in Smyrna. Now let's look at its relevance. And as I thought about this, I just couldn't help but be impressed. You know, it's good to do that. I've said it before, I'll say it again. As you read Scripture, don't just treat it as another textbook. It's that and more. As you read, be conscious of any particular impression that the Spirit might be implanting on your mind. As I thought of this subject of suffering, I thought, well, it's not frequently spoken about these days. I mean, Christianity these days is portrayed as something where there's all smiles. You know, if you go around with anything less than a cheesy grin, there's something wrong. You've backslidden, brother. We don't seem to give any place to suffering. We don't seem to give equal credit to the experience of persecution and sorrow, as we do seem to emphasise. I mean, I'm talking about Christianity in general and the views that seem to be portrayed these days, as we do seem to emphasise the joyful, happy, rejoicing aspect of it. And let's face it, there are certain groups, particularly of believers, who seem to put every bit of weight on the happy, smile, singing, rejoicing phase or aspects of Christian experience, and they're not quite so vocal. They're not quite so vocal on the persecution, the suffering, the sorrowful phase. I wonder how they fit in the Gethsemane experience. There was nothing joyful about that, was there? I think he heard it Friday night as he fell prostrate to the ground, praying three times. And the 3 hours of darkness, nothing rejoicing about that. But it was just as much essential Christian experience, we may say. It was just as essential as it was the moments of his rejoicing and the moments of his gladness. So to sort of put an overemphasis on the one at the expense of the other doesn't even fit in with Christ's teaching. He says himself, "If the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you." So he's conditioning his disciples there in John 15 to experience this persecution, this opposition. And he says it's just as necessary that you should suffer it as it was and as it is that I should suffer it. I mean, he says a servant is not greater than his Lord. So I mean, if I've suffered it, the argument is, what hope have you got of avoiding it? So it's very much an essential part of Christ's teaching. If you were of the world, he says, the world would love his own. But because you're not of the world, but I've chosen you out of the world, therefore, he says, the world hates you. Morally, you don't fit. I wonder if we feel social misfits this morning. You know, the title social misfit has been used and almost to sum up someone who has some mental disorder or psychological problem. But in terms of the Christian experience, it is very true that every Christian is really a social misfit. Because we just don't fit. We were never meant to fit. He didn't belong here. It's his argument, it's his teaching. So what hope have we got of ever feeling as though we belong here? What does James say? He says, friendship with the world, if I befriend the world, then I am constituting myself an enemy of God. My, who wants to do that? So you see, this suffering aspect and persecution is very much an essential part of the Christian experience, just as equally as the rejoicing and the happiness and the fellowship part as well. I don't know, do you see my point? I really honestly feel that Christendom in general is emphasising the one at the expense of the other. I really do. And our young people are being brought up perhaps to think that it's all a bed of roses. You know? No. Not so, is it? He continues in John 16, verses 1 to 3, similar sorts of thoughts. It's a mouthful. 2 Timothy 3 and 10, the apostle talks about persecutions and afflictions. And he says, you know what? All that will live godly will suffer persecution. Now you say, well, I'm not really very godly. Okay. But it's not just all the who are godly. It's all who will to live godly. In other words, anyone who has the slightest ambition of being like the character of God and reflecting the character of God will essentially suffer persecution. I like that. Otherwise, it could be just sort of pigeonholed aside for those who are godly, whoever they might be. But no, he says, Paul writes to Timothy, he says, if you've got any ambition, the slightest ambition to be as upright and righteous and holy and pure as the very character of God itself, he says, you will find that you suffer persecution in the process. He says, I've suffered persecutions, afflictions, and so on. He lists it all there in 2 Corinthians 11. He suffered smitings, he suffered all sorts of hatred and persecutions, didn't he, the Apostle Paul, and you can read it all there. So number one, it is an essential part of the Christian experience. That's in keeping with Christ's teaching, so be careful of that, particularly as you move about and mix with other Christian viewpoints. Also, not only is it in perfect harmony with Christ's teaching, but it's also in perfect harmony with apostolic teaching, as we've noticed in relation to the apostle. And finally, you know what Peter says? He says, you rejoice that you're even called to suffer, that you're even counted worthy to suffer. Be glad that God has chosen you out as someone who can suffer with Christ and for Christ's sake. Mind you, says Peter, be careful that you're suffering for the right reason. He says, you know, we get ourselves in hot water sometimes. I mean, I'm done that as well. I'm sure you have too. So don't just all sort of pigeonhole it. Let's all classify it as suffering for Christ. You ensure that you're suffering with him and for his sake before you say that I'm suffering for the right reason. Then Peter writes and says, now you rejoice that you're counted worthy to just suffer for his sake. You know, we just sang of Christ's likeness. And we all no doubt had rosy pictures of righteousness, holiness, purity. And they're right too, they're very accurate too. But just remember, and I have to remind myself as well, that to suffer for the right reason is just as much an essential part of Christ's likeness as all the other qualities that you could ever consider to be like him. So Peter says, rejoice in that you're counted worthy. I enjoyed the next one particularly. How's our time? Okay, the sufficiency of Christ. Let's look at how the letter begins. Verse number 8. These things saith the first and the last, which was dead and is alive again. Now I've enjoyed noticing that in the introduction to each of the seven letters, you find Christ portrays and presents himself in a particular way. In Ephesus, the first letter we had, it was the one who holds the seven stars in his right hand. Wrong hand. Right? And walks in the midst of the seven golden lampstands. And in each letter, you'll notice that Christ portrays him in a certain way. And boy, oh boy, it's wonderful to see the significance of that representation, of that portrayal. And I've just made a few notes as I was looking at it this week. In Ephesus, remember, you had coldness of heart. And that's when I feel that the revelation of Christ holding the seven stars in his right hand, with the thought it's not just having, as we read in another one of the churches there, but it's holding. There's the thought of closeness. There's the thought of intimacy. There's the thought of affection. And for a people who are growing cold of heart, how reassuring, how heartwarming to know that they are resting and they are being held on to dearly in an affectionate embrace by the man who walks midst the golden lampstands. Isn't that wonderful? You can see the suitability of it. If anyone here is growing cold of heart, then we can apply that, can't we? We all do at times. Things may get us down. I know ideally they shouldn't, although as we've said, suffering is just as much legitimate as rejoicing. Then you find yourself just getting cold of heart, and you're reading less, you're praying less, you're less conscious of the presence of God than you once were. Here's something that'll warm you all over again, just to know that you're being supported, you're being upheld, you are in the embrace. That's it. I'm in the embrace of Christ as he holds the seven stars. I think it's wonderful. Isn't it great? We're so close to him. We couldn't be closer. We talk about earthly relationships. We spend lots of time on them. And of course we have to give them their place. We get carried away with the development of relationships on earth, perhaps. But hang on now. Here's a relationship that's fixed, that's final, that's firm. And it couldn't be more intimate. You know, the world out there talks about intimacy. They think of one thing. That's all they think of. And it's usually in the gutter. But here's an intimacy that's wholesome and that's pure, as he holds the seven stars there. Let's go down to Smyrna now. What do you got there? Well, I think Brother John may have been helping us with a bit of understanding on this a month or so back. You've got him who is the first and the last. The beginning and the end. The first and the last. And as was pointed out to us, there is no situation, there is no experience that the Christian can endure or suffer that is not within the embrace, not within the understanding of the person of our Lord Jesus. He's the first and the last. Anything that happens to me is in between. There is nothing that occurs outside his knowledge, nothing that occurs outside him. I think that's great. So as these people in Smyrna were suffering a period of martyrdom for about 2 centuries, I understand, almost constant martyrdom, they sort of lived in, gathered in caves and in secret places. They posted a sentry to watch for any of the foes that may spy them out. They lived in fear of this intense hatred and opposition. And to know that every experience they suffered was all within the understanding, was all within the perfect knowledge of our Lord Jesus, would surely reassure them. Not only that, but he says, I'm the one who was dead. He says, look, you're not going to suffer anything that I haven't suffered. He was dead. I mean, they were facing martyrdom. You can see the point of him presenting himself as the one who was dead. But what's more, he says, I have superiority over death. I am above and beyond death. And this morning he exists on a plane that is above and beyond even the dark experience of death. And he says, I was dead, sure, but I am alive. And as we know, that forevermore. So as the martyr would, or as those believers would consider martyrdom, ultimately losing their lives, their faith could well be directed to a man who understood every situation and had every experience in his embrace. Not only that, but they could also lift their gaze to a man who was dead, who has been through the experience himself, but is now alive again. It's Hebrew truth almost all over again, isn't it? What qualifies me to sympathise? Well, I've got to be understanding. I've got to have a listening ear. I've got to have a heart for people. All those things. But the ultimate qualifier to sympathy, as revealed in the Hebrew epistle, isn't it, is the fact that he's been there. He's been through it before. And there's no temptation, no suffering that we endure that he hasn't also experienced himself. He's got first-hand experience, and first-hand experience always qualifies a person to sympathise and to succour and to support. Isn't it great? So there's nothing that you're going through now, nothing that I will ever go through, that he does not understand and he hasn't been through himself. What a blessing we have to have a man like that on the throne, or at least on the right hand of the throne this morning. Then you go over to Pergamos and it's just as relevant. What have you got in Pergamos? Well, you've got lots of enemies there. So what have you got a revelation in verse 12 of Christ there? These things saith he which hath the sharp sword with two edges. You've got a Christ as judge, one of great power and of great force, with a sharp sword with two edges. Now of course in Pergamos you've got the error of Balaam. You've got the Nicolaitans. You seem to have all these adversaries. You've got where Satan dwells. They're existing in a region, obviously, which is satanic. And it's where Satan dwells. And what do they need to know? They need to have their eyes on a Christ who's all-powerful for all those enemies. As he has a sharp sword with two edges. See the relevance there again. Jump over to Thyatira, and that's verse 18. Thyatira, you have error, particularly, seems to be there. You've got that woman Jezebel. And what have you got, the revelation of Christ in verse 18? He's got eyes like unto flames of fire, his feet as burnished bronze or fine brass. So you've got him there revealed with power to discern. I mean, eyes as flames of fire that would pierce to the innermost recesses of things. You know? Bronze always, brass always represents sin that's judged in the brazen altar and so on, the tabernacle. So you have a Christ who is discerning. That's what they need when there's the error of this teaching, the error of that teaching. They need to have their eyes lifted to a man who has the power to discern and the power to convict. And over to Sardis then in chapter 3 and verse 1. What have you got in Sardis? Well, you've got weakness. And how does Christ present himself in verse 1? He says he has the seven spirits of God. How's that? All powerful. So when you're in a weak spot, when you're in a weak assembly, we've all been in them. If only we could lift our eyes and understand that Christ has all power. He says he has the seven spirits of God. You couldn't get any more power than that. Perfect power. We'll have to keep moving there. And we go over now to Philadelphia. What do you find there? Chapter 3, verse 7. Again, you've got weakness. And you've got organized opposition. And Christ presents himself in verse 7. As the one who has the key of David, administrative power. You've got the synagogue of Satan mentioned there in relation to Philadelphia. So, you know, the opposition was institutionalized. It was administered from ahead. It was almost governmental. So Christ there has the key of David. He has an administration. Right. So it's sort of Christ has the power for administration of lips particularly, and then Laodicea, the last one. You've got lukewarmness and insensitivity. What do you got? Christ revealing himself there as the faithful and true witness. Laodicea had failed and was failing in relation to their witness of God, in relation to their faithfulness to God. So Christ presents himself there and introduces himself as the faithful and true witness. So I think you'll agree that in one of the seven, Christ presents himself as all-sufficient. No matter what the need is, he is enough. Now that's a massive lesson to learn, and I don't pretend to have learnt it. When assemblies tend to fall apart a little, we tend to go to jelly. I know I do. I guess it's a good sign, at least you care. It's better than shrugging your shoulders and not worrying. But ideally, I should be able to lift my gaze and get my gaze fixed again on the Christ who is head of the church and understand that, well, the assembly may be weak and has its weak spots, but he is the all-sufficient one. He has the answers. And as that chorus says, he's all I need. He's all I need. Philip understood that, show us the Father and it's sufficient for us. I think that, you know, when it comes to getting saved, we sort of have to get to that point, don't we, where Christ is all we need. But then we seem to forget that. We go through the Christian experience and we tend to sort of try and carry the load ourselves, perhaps. Then we get to the assembly, then and we're really sort of open then, and we sort of allow ourselves to really carry things along, perhaps, ourselves. But we need to know, just as really on the day of our conversion, and we need to try and remind ourselves that we're going to need Christ, and we're going to have to put our faith in the sufficiency of Christ every step of the way, not just for conversion. Well, time's just about gone and here we are halfway through, but I hope and trust that was something blessed for you. Well, just fly down the last few. Their condition materially says, look, you're poor, impoverished. Verse 9, that is. I know your works and tribulation and poverty. But he says, even though you don't have much materially, you know, he says, you know, when it comes to your faith, you're rich. It's like James. James says, look, don't give the rich people first place. The man that's got the ring, or gay clothing, or colourful clothing, don't give that sort of guy first place. Because he says, you know, God has not chosen you because of any of that. But he says, it's the poor of this world who are rich in faith that we're meant to give place to. Our calling from God has got nothing to do with anything of ourselves. It's because of our faith, richness in faith. So the writer of Christ addresses the church here and he says, look, you're impoverished, sure. But he says, you really are very rich. Be glad of that. Now, of course, we're living in days of plenty to a great extent. And I guess we're a bit remote from this type of verse. But the teaching's there for when the experience comes, at least. Next, the opposition. It was political. As I've said, two whole centuries of almost constant martyrdom. And, you know, when you live in fear of that, well, you don't mess around with trivia. You know? Life is just too precious then. And Christian service, I'm sure we'd have this hall packed if that was the situation out there. And we'd all be on fire far more for God if that was the situation here. But no, complacency comes in because of ease. It's like Mr. Oldfield was saying, when there's ease, we tend to be lukewarm. But these folk here were suffering politically, and there was also the religious opposition. See, there was spiritual attack as well. You've got mention made there of those who call themselves Jews. The Jews have frequently been the opposition, haven't they? And been opposed to the Christian faith. Remember Luke 4. Jesus goes into the synagogue on the Sabbath day. He stands up and he reads these verses and the Jewish company there are impressed. Wow, they say. What gracious words proceeded out of his mouth. Until he started to apply it to the Gentiles. And the next thing we read about, they want to throw him down the hill. Cast him headlong down the hill. The Jews have had a great claim to God, as we know, and that's Romans 3, is it? Romans 2. to them was committed the oracles of God, or the Word of God, the voice of God. And they find it hard to realize that God has bypassed them, particularly as a nation for the moment, and focused instead on the Gentile, that's us, on the heathen. So in this time, Smyrna here, they were suffering from those who were Jewish in origin. But he says, look, they're not really Jewish in character. They're not really God's people in character. They say they are Jews, but are not. He says, you know what they belong to? They belong to a great organization. They belong to a great system or institution called the Synagogue of Satan. So these folk were suffering in the spiritual realm as well as in the political realm. But then encouragements follow. He says, look, he says, you're going to have tribulation for 10 days. And whether you want to take that literally or not, doesn't really matter. But the great point is this. First off, he says, the time's limited. And if Christ says that you're going to have trouble 10 days, no one's going to make it 11, are they? It's like Job's experience. He was allowed to be touched, sure, or rather to be affected. But God says, you can go so far and no further. God understands where the breaking point is, perhaps. He knows how much I can take. He knows how much you can take. And sometimes we get beyond ourselves and we get to the bottom of our experience and we really sort of feel we can't take any more. Well, maybe we can, maybe we can't. He knows us better than we know ourselves. And they were going to have tribulation for 10 days and no man could make it 11. So Christ says, look, he says, it's limited. And I'll make sure it's limited. What's more, he says, I know the future. He says, you're going to have tribulation 10 days. I know what's coming to you. Don't think it's coming or happening outside my knowledge. You ever go through things and things fall apart and you think, well, I wonder if this just came out of the blue. No, it didn't come out of the blue. God foreknew. Christ foreknew. And that's the thought here. What comfort there is. He knows. He knew it was going to happen. He foreknew it. And what's more, it's limited, he says here. But he says, be faithful unto death. And what's more, he says, I'll give you a crown of life. And there's a blessing in that too. The very thing that man was trying to rob them of, Christ was going to give them. And I promise you, the crown of life that Christ was going to give them could never be taken from them ever again. The crown of life. Isn't that great? You see how suitable the address of the is to the assembly in view of their situation. I'll give you, he says, a crown of life. And then the general appeal goes out. We'll finish on this in verse 11. He says, he that has an ear, let him hear. It's possible to hear with the ear and not with the understanding. He says, if you've got ears to hear, use them. Learn the lessons from it. And this is why we're looking at these seven churches, that we all can hear what the Spirit is saying to us. He says, he that has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says unto the churches. And here it is again. He that overcomes shall not be hurt of the second death. In other words, they may rob you of natural death, or natural life rather. But he says, one thing's for sure, you'll never be touched by that second death, which is a lake of fire death. I commend it to you and trust that God will bless his word and it might be an encouragement to us, particularly if we're going through hardship or if we're going to go through hardship. And let's face it, man is born to trouble as sure as the sparks fly upward. So let's not think that we're going to go through life, no matter how young we are, and it's all going to be easy. We're going to need teaching like Smyrna, no doubt, teaching to equip us for the experiences of life. Commend it to you and trust it will be a help.